Welcome to another Nassau Institute podcast. We have the pleasure of presenting Dr. Don Boudreau, Chairman of the Economics Department at George Mason University, on globalization, the subject of his recently released book. He spoke at a Nassau Institute dinner on March 6, 2008, and gave us permission to record it for this podcast. Thanks to Dr. Boudreau, our sponsors, and guests for making it such a memorable evening. We certainly hope you enjoy it.
Hello. Good evening. May I have your attention? I think we're going to get started. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Maria Camargo. I'm the newest member of the gang. And on behalf of the Nassau Institute, I would like to welcome you all to tonight's conference on globalization by Dr. Don Boudreau. I would also like to thank you for coming tonight and supporting the Institute. I also like to give a special thanks to our sponsors who, with their generous gifts, have made us possible to make this event. And I'm going to read the list of the sponsors tonight. They are Bahamas Realty, The Luggage Store, CBS Bahamas, Custom Computers, the Delvenas Agency, Executive Printers, MNC Leasing, RBC Finca, Security and General, Taylor Industries, and Tropical Shipping. Okay. Thank you very much. Yes. Also, please take a look at the wonderful bags you have in front of you. They're filled with information and great goodies from our sponsors. Apparently tonight they're very good too, and yes, exactly. We couldn't find a bigger box. And I also like to call your attention and encourage you to go to the Nassau Institute website, in which you can subscribe to our newsletter. I put your email there, and then that way you'll be able to get the announcements for next events, upcoming events, and read wonderful articles that we post every week. A little housekeeping point tonight. Due to some misunderstanding with the schedule and the hotel, dinner is going to start at 7:30, so we are just going to start our conference and keep going, and then you're going to get to the food a little later tonight. But it'll be very good. Yes. No, don't worry. You'll get it. And we have the conference, we'll have the dinner, and then we allow some time for our speaker to answer some questions that you all may have. And now, Sydney going to do the presentation? Sydney, or you're going to do the presentation? You are? Okay, and now I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Sydney Sweeting, Director of the Nassau Institute, who will present you with Dr. Don Boudreau.
Our speaker tonight earned his PhD in economics from Auburn University in 1986 and his law degree from the University of Virginia in 1992. He has served as assistant professor of economics at George Mason University, associate professor of legal studies and economics at Clemson University, president of the Foundation for Economic Education, and since 2001, he has been chairman of the Department of Economics at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He has published in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, the Journal of Commerce, the Cato Journal, and several scholarly journals such as the Supreme Court Economic Review, the Southern Economic Journal, and the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking. He has lectured in the United States, Canada, Latin America, and Europe. In 2007, he achieved a lifetime dream when he was invited by the NASA Institute to speak to a distinguished group at the Hilton Hotel in Nassau, Bahamas. I knew I shouldn't have had to write this for me. Ladies and gentlemen, we are extremely proud to have Dr. Donald Boudreau. Please give him a warm welcome.
Thanks. It's a genuine pleasure to be here. Rick and I have been emailing for quite some time now, several months, about my coming, and about the only thing I really insisted is that I come during the winter months living in Washington. Although because of global warming, Washington's had palm trees are starting to sprout up on the mall, so it's indistinguishable from here. Not true, of course. I am pleased to be here. Before I start, I want to give a plug to my book, which is kind of the basis of what I'll talk about tonight, Globalization. I recommend you buy several copies. They make great gifts. Christmas, Hanukkah, gifts for pets. Let me just buy several copies. Anyway, I've been an economist for, I count from the time I began studying the subject in 1977, so for 31 years now. And there's nothing that I love more than economics, and the ideas that I share with you tonight are ideas that date back, that started to take form in my mind from the very first moment that I began studying economics. I say that because oftentimes when I give a lecture such as this, and this is a new lecture for me, this particular version of it, I'm accused of being a corporate shill, of having the views I do because I'm a tenured college professor. And I tell a lot of people who accuse me of being a corporate shill that a real corporate shill would actually get the money from the corporation. I don't get any money from corporations. And if I did, maybe I would say something they want me to say. But I say what I want to say because I think it to be right. It may be right. It may be wrong. But I think it's right because no one pays me to say it. It's just what I believe. So look around. I mean, just look around you in this room and notice all the what we regard as mundane things in our life. We have artificial lighting, you have indoor plumbing, you have clothes on your bodies, you've all showered and bathed and brushed your teeth, and most of you have vision correction. my 10-year-old son has vision correction. And it's the world we live in is full of these wonders. And ask yourself, it's a simple question, ask yourself, how many of these things could you yourself make by yourself? How many of these things could you even begin to grasp the knowledge of how to make by yourself? And the answer you'll quickly discover if you truly reflect upon it is none. One of the distinguishing facts about industrial modern society is that virtually everything we consume is something that none of us who consume them could make by ourselves. If we had to live, put it another way, if we had to live off of all the things that we personally could produce for ourselves, we would all be miserably, oppressively poor. Actually, we'd be dead. But if we managed to survive, we would be very poor. And it's even deeper. Not only could you not make it, everything in this room that you see, everything that you consume in your daily life is something that, and get this, no one knows how to make. It's not that you don't know how to make it, that you can't make it. No one in the world knows how to make it. Everything that we consume is something that is the product of the knowledge, the information, and the effort of literally millions of people. Literally millions of people spread across time and space. If that sounds odd to you, I normally don't do this, but I think this is such a beautiful quotation. I'm going to read a fairly lengthy quotation from a book by an economist in Toulouse, France, named Paul Sebright. And I quote it in my book. I just want to read you this quotation from economist Sebright's explanation of a shirt that he bought. I'm quoting now from Paul Sievers, from a book he wrote in 2004 called The Company of Strangers. Although a simple item by the standards of modern technology, each shirt represents a triumph of international cooperation. The cotton was grown in India from seeds developed in the United States. The artificial fiber in the thread comes from Portugal, and the material in the dyes from at least six other countries. The collar linings come from Brazil, and the machinery for weaving, cutting, and sewing from Germany. The shirt itself was made up in Malaysia. The project of making a shirt and delivering it to me in Toulouse has been a long time in the planning, since well before the morning 2 winters ago when an Indian farmer first led a pair of plowing bullocks across his land onto the red plains outside of Coimbatore. I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly. Engineers in Cologne and chemists in Birmingham, England, were involved in the preparation many years ago. Most remarkably of all, given the obstacles it had to surmount to be made at all and the large number of people who have been involved along the way, it's a very stylish and attractive shirt. And yet I am quite sure that nobody knew that I was going to be buying a shirt of this kind today. I hardly knew it myself the day before. Every single one of these people who has been laboring to bring this shirt to me has done so without knowing or indeed caring anything about me. There's a lot of, end quote, there's a lot of lessons in that quotation. But what I want to emphasize is that everything you see is the product of enormously complex human cooperation. And we take it for granted. We take it for granted in the same way that fish take for granted the water that they swim in. You know, I don't think a fish wakes up in the morning and thinks, oh, thank goodness they have water. It's just what the fish lives in. We live, we in the modern industrial world, live in an enormous array of material wealth that's so common to us that we take it for granted. And I will take for granted for the rest of this talk that this material wealth is good. I teach college students and a lot of 18-year-old young college students wishing to be rather revolutionary will sometimes challenge me. They don't like wealth. And I always tell them, not to be mean, I always tell them, well, you don't have to have wealth. You can. There are lots of places in the world where you can go and live, literally live off the earth. And, but something kind of ironic about an 18-year-old American kid telling me, you know, sitting in a suburb classroom in Washington, D.C., telling me that he doesn't like wealth. So, well, prove it. go not have material wealth. I will assume that material wealth is desirable. I'm not assuming that it's perfect. I don't, by no means do I believe that it brings heaven on earth. But I assume that more material wealth is better than less material wealth, and that most people in the world want more material wealth, and that if most people in the world could find institutions and ways of bringing about greater amounts of material wealth, they would do so. That Seabright quotation captures nicely what I mean by globalization. My definition of globalization is very simple. I define globalization as the spread across political boundaries of human cooperation. That's all I mean by globalization. I do not, I want to say, mean when I speak about globalization, I do not confound that with questions about immigration. I think those are interesting questions that should be addressed, but we can discuss international trade of goods and services independently from questions of immigration. And I think the two should be kept separate because they do, while they involve many similar issues, they involve also some separate issues, and to confound the two only confuses discussion. So I'm not talking tonight about immigration. And I also want to emphasize I am not talking about one world government. A lot of people, when they hear the term globalization, they, for reasons that frankly baffle me, they think I'm talking about one world government. I am emphatically not talking about one world government. Globalization, as I understand it, means the very opposite of one world government. Far from trying to impose a single government, globalization is an attempt to devolve sovereignty down, to devolve it down as far as it can possibly go, that is to the level of the individual. Freeing trade means empowering individuals to take power from states and bureaucrats in order to decide how they spend their money and how they invest money. I'm not here questioning the need at some level for governments to perform certain services. I am questioning the need and the desirability of governments to sit in judgment over how their people spend their money and how they invest their funds. And so what I mean by globalization is taking power from centralized institutions and devolving it down decentrally. Emphatically not the same thing as a one world government where you take all power and you move it upward. The Economist's case for free trade is not complicated. It dates back to Adam Smith. Adam Smith's book, written in 1776, I like to tell my students that that was the most important event of that very eventful year. It was published in March of 1776. And the full title of that book, by the way, is important. Most people just refer to Adam Smith's book as The Wealth of Nations. It's a nice shorthand term. But the full title is really revealing. The full title is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. And so note a couple of things about the title. He inquired, number one, into the nature of wealth. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but let me just briefly say Adam Smith emphatically tried to, and he succeeded, by the way, to debunk the then widespread mercantilist fallacy that nations were wealthy if they had a lot of money. Right? And Smith said, look, this is my own words. Smith said, wealth is not money. Wealth is the ability to consume. You can't clothe yourself with money. You can't eat money. You can't house yourself in money. Money won't take you to a nice vacation in the Bahamas or in Florida or in Paris. Money is worthwhile only insofar as it can be exchanged for things that we want to consume, real goods and services, not money. So the nature of wealth is the ability of ordinary people to consume. But the most important part of the title, in my view, is he says he's inquiring into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. First of all, notice, he didn't inquire into the nature, into the causes of poverty. Today, because our world is so wealthy, we actually oftentimes talk about the causes of poverty. What causes poverty? For Adam Smith, that would have been an absurd question. Poverty is the human default mode. It's not a challenge to be poverty-stricken. Anybody can do it. Right? It's not a challenge. You pop out of the womb and do nothing, and you're poverty-stricken. What is a challenge is to create wealth. And Smith knew enough history, my cell phone. I just want to make sure I have a slight family emergency, so you'll have to excuse me. Hello, Mary. I'm giving a talk. Yeah, is she okay? Is she okay? Okay. I'll call you back in a little bit. Okay. I gotta go. Bye bye. I'm sorry. I normally don't keep my cell phone when I'm giving talks, but I discovered just before I came here that my mother's in intensive care, and so that was my sister calling, and so I had to take her message. Well, I got just enough information to know that I can delay. It's very awkward. I'm sorry. Okay, back to Adam Smith. Okay. So Smith he's inquiring into the causes of wealth, and so he looks so he. Smith traveled throughout Western Europe, and he noticed that some countries were wealthier than others. He noticed that the lowlands of Scotland and England, people there were wealthier than were people in Spain. He noticed that people in Western France were wealthier than the people in Southern Italy. For example, he says, what causes? Why are ordinary Englishmen growing in wealth today? Why are we wealthier today than we were 100 years ago? Why are people in England today wealthier than people in Spain? What causes wealth? For most of human history, we weren't wealthy. One of my favorite hobbies, by the way, is to read history. I like reading history. One of my favorite historians is a French historian, the late Ferdinand Braudel. He was something of a Marxist, but he was a great historian. He specialized, he pioneered, actually, in the history of everyday life. And he has a wonderful book that came out in English translation in 1981 called The Structures of Everyday Life. And it's 687 pages of documenting just misery, how ordinary people lived between the 15th and the 18th century, mostly in Europe, but he has data from other continents as well. And it's just dreary and miserable. People were dying at young ages. Children were always dying. Everybody had smallpox. Everybody was bent over because they were malnourished. They were all filthy. They never bathed. They lived in the horribly filthy one-room huts with no privacy. When they weren't starving, they were dying of disease and plague. That was what the world was like before the Industrial Age. Smith knew that. So why now? Why, starting from about the time Adam Smith wrote, why has there been this terrific wealth explosion? What causes that? Smith began his 1776 book, chapter 1, book 1, entitled Of the Division of Labor. That was his explanation. He said wealth is caused by the division of labor. Wealth is caused by specialization. When we each specialize according to what we do best, then we get better at it. And then we trade with each other, and then we're all wealthier as a consequence. Smith gave three reasons why this is so. He said, well, you know, when you specialize, if you specialize doing one thing, you don't have to sort of waste time running from task to task. I mean, if I was a corn farmer in the morning and then I was a window cleaner in Manhattan in the afternoon, it would take me a lot of time moving from, you know, the corn farm to Manhattan to scrape windows at night. So I stay on the farm and grow corn, let someone else grow, clean windows, and we both produce more. As a result, society is wealthier. I think it's an important reason. It's not the most enlightening thing, but it's true. A second reason Smith gave for why specialization increases wealth is that when we specialize, and you know this, you become better at what you do. If you spend you know, hours every day playing the piano, you become better at playing the piano. You may never become Vladimir Horowitz, but you become better than you would be if you spent only 5 minutes doing it. So each of you in here, I'm sure, has a career, one that you worked at for many years. The more you do it, you get skills at doing it, and you are able to produce more output per unit of time, per hour, per day than you could if you divided your time doing a whole bunch of other things. Believe it or not, you would never tell from this talk, I'm a better speaker now than I used to be. Because I, for reasons that I can't figure out, people ask me to do a lot of it. Right? And so a third reason Smith gave is that when people specialize in tasks, it's more likely that machinery will be invented to take over that task, and thereby releasing those workers to do other things that could not otherwise be done. And so if someone's, the example Smith gave was of a pin factory, if someone's producing pins and doing everything in a factory involved in the making of a pin, pulling out the wire, sharpening it, polishing it, doing whatever it takes to do to make a pin, it's very hard to make a machine and do all that. But as labor specializes, it's more likely to dawn on someone, hey, I can make a machine to do that. And so things become mechanized. And that's the really important thing, I think, that Smith put his finger on. Specialization not only leads to increases of output in itself, it increases the potential and the opportunity for mechanization, which releases that most scarce of all resources, the ultimate resource, human labor, to do other things that can otherwise not be done. So those are just three reasons Adam Smith gave for why specialization increases wealth. And Smith understood that the greater the number of people you have working in an economy, the greater are the abilities to specialize. Not only can we specialize, you know, not only can I specialize in making corn and you specialize in cleaning skyscraper windows, we might even be able to subdivide those tasks. I specialize in just planting corn seed or sorting corn seed, and you specialize in just running the scaffolding up the building, and someone else specializes in doing the scraping. The greater the number of people we have, the more fine the jobs become. Think of the medical profession, for example. 100 years ago, there weren't that many specialties. Now, we have these incredibly detailed specialties. And as a result, the quality of the output is higher, and that means the quality of the life of those of us who consume those outputs is higher. I have a 10-year-old son who a few years ago was very ill. Fortunately now he's fine, but he was in the hospital for a month. He had a digestive ailment. And I didn't know until my son was in the hospital in the year 2000 that there was medical specialists. This person, these doctors, they had a whole team of them. They were specialists in pediatrics, gastroenterology, or something like that. Who knew? I didn't know, but I'm darn glad that they did have the specialty, because I'm convinced that they saved my son's life. I think he would have died had these people not had the knowledge and the deep knowledge that they had, the time to dedicate to taking care of him that they did. And I'm just an ordinary middle-class American. It's not like I'm Bill Gates. I aspire to be Bill Gates, but I have several zeros to go in my bank account. Now, for those of you who know economics, you know, have to know, there's another much more important, not more important, a different kind of reason in addition to those that Smith gave for why specialization is so important. That was given by Smith's successor as the great English economist, a man named David Ricardo, who, by the way, David Ricardo himself is a great testament to globalization. You can tell by his name, David Ricardo, that it's not a typical English name. It's Spanish. His ancestors were born in Spain a few centuries earlier. They were very devout Jews, Orthodox Jews, and when the Inquisition in Spain got a little, you know, enthusiastic about Roman Catholicism, it became very uncomfortable to be Jews in Spain, and so there was a Jewish diaspora. One of the many Jewish diasporas then from Spain, and the Ricardo's ancestors fled from Spain to England. It's an example of globalization. This man came from, his family came from Spain to England. He himself became a very productive stock trader and political economist. And David Ricardo is the first person to articulate what we know now as the theory of comparative advantage. The theory of comparative advantage is one of the more, I think it's probably the most counterintuitive things in all of basic economics. And so it's not my place here. I don't have time to run through it. But let me just say, the key insight of the principle of comparative advantage, and it's a beautiful insight when I teach the principle of comparative advantage, I get goosebumps still. I mean, it makes me happy. I get excited, and I love it. Because one of the key insights is, people worry that so-and-so is so efficient, he's better producing everything than this person over here. And the principle of comparative advantage says, no, that's impossible. Practically impossible. Can't happen. And think about it. Let's say you were a really good fisherman. Right? This is the exact example I use in my class, not because I'm here in the Bahamas. If you're a really good fisherman, and you become better at fishing. To become better at fishing means you become worse at everything else. Because to become better at fishing means that every bit of your time that you spend fishing, you're able to get more and more fish than you were before you became better at it. And so by not spending time fishing and you become better at it, that means you forego all those fish that you can catch. That's one of the key insights of the principle of comparative advantage, that to become better at something, you become comparatively worse at something else, meaning that other people now have an opportunity to supply you with those other things that are now too costly for you to produce. Anyway, these reasons for why specialization increase output form the core not only of the modern economic theory of international trade, they form the core of the very beginnings of economics. Economics began as a discipline in an attempt to refute the mercantilist fallacies that were then running rampant throughout Europe. I call them fallacies. I guess it's a little bit of a loaded term. I believe they were fallacies. Smith and Ricardo believe they were fallacies. And I expose, in one sense, my goal here tonight is to at least persuade you that there's some reason to think that belief in protectionism is a fallacy. But If you look around you, these are not abstract theories desperate for application. None of us could produce one billionth of what we consume, and yet we consume it all regularly. And the reason we do is because we are part of an economy of millions of people. And so the economic case for free trade is to say there's nothing special about political borders. If our prosperity increases when we increase specialization across two people to four people to eight people, and it continues to increase as we increase our specialization to millions of people and hundreds of millions of people. Let me just mention it real quickly before moving on, a couple of other reasons why the larger the market, the greater the likelihood of material prosperity, widespread material prosperity. I've already given a few. Greater specialization means greater output. The greater the number of people, the greater the opportunities for specialization, and hence the greater the output. Another reason, and this was actually hinted at by Adam Smith, some say more than hinted at, is that the larger the market, the greater the opportunities there are to spread fixed costs. Ask yourself this question. Do you think it's more likely that a life-saving drug would be developed if the potential market for that drug consists of 1,000 people or if it consists of 1 million people? Now, all of us would agree that if you have 1,000 people who are stricken with or who are at risk of being stricken with a horrible, debilitating, deadly disease, it would be wonderful to have a drug developed for those people. But developing drugs is costly. It takes years of research, huge amounts of investment in experimentation, and testing, and verification. And these costs are all incurred up front. It may be, in fact, it often is, the case that the drug development process leads to a dead end. As we say, nothing happens, so you have millions of dollars proved to go down the drain. So if you're an investor or a drug company and you're investing, you want to decide where to direct your investments to cure a disease, you know you're going to have a lot of fixed costs. Well, you'll devote your money more likely to try to cure a disease that afflicts a lot of people than to one that afflicts a small number of people. One of the advantages of globalization is that by expanding the market, it enables firms and investors to spread their fixed costs out more broadly. If the United States, for example, had a closed market, and the United States is a big country, it's 300 million people, so that's, Americans wouldn't be destitute if Uncle Sam shut the door. We'd be poorer than we are now, but we wouldn't be destitute. But 300 million people still is not the same as 3 billion people. Expanding the number of potential customers increases the potential customer base, and that increases the potential to spread those fixed costs, and hence it increases the attractiveness of investing in those ways. Globalization also, contrary to a lot of mythology, makes our lives less risky. If you were dependent for your food upon one region of the world, and that region of the world were stricken with a flood or a drought or a pestilence, then you might starve to death. Again, which is the common fate of most of our ancestors for the tens of thousands of years that we lived prior to the Industrial Age. You might starve to death. But if you diversify your source of food, not only to this part of the globe, but to this part and that part, chances that a pestilence or a flood or a drought will wipe out your entire source of food begin to fall dramatically. It won't. It's unlikely to happen. Also, having this larger group of people involved in trade, not only does it bring literally, numerically, more resources into the economy of which you're a part, into the global economy, it brings more creativity into that economy. One arithmetical fact that I discovered several years ago, and then amazed me when I discovered it, is the following. I'm going to tell you this fact, and I hope you're as amazed by it as I was. I confess, when I heard it, I didn't believe it. You should feel free to not believe me. Because when I heard it, I'm going to check this on my calculator. So I went back, got my calculator, and sure enough, it's true. So and I've done it many, many times, and I guarantee it's true. So here's the deal. Right. If I have, let's say, three items, right, my sacred glass of wine, a pen, and my watch. I ask you, how many different ways can I arrange these three items just in a single dimension? And the answer is six. I can put my watch, the glass of wine, the pen, the glass of wine, the watch, the pen, the watch. I can do it six ways. If you go in your calculator, you'll see an X with an exclamation point behind it. Right? What's that? It's an X factorial. And actually, that exclamation point, I think, is there for a good reason. Because I'm about to tell you, I think it's amazing. It's like a wow, right? So here's the thing. If I have four, by the way, arithmetic, what is it? The way you figure it out is just the number of items, 3 times 2 times 1. If you have 4 items, it's 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. So if you have 4 items, the number of different ways I can arrange these different items is 24. 4 times 3 is 12 times 2 is 24 times 1 is 24. If I have 20 items, not a lot, let's say I have 20 different pieces of fruit. I have an apple, a banana, a cantaloupe, a date, a eucalyptus leaf, a grape, a fig, you know, or you get it. I have 20 items, just 20 fruit. I ask, how many different ways can I arrange them in a single dimension? The number of different ways to arrange those 20 items in a single dimension is greater by 8 times greater than the number of seconds in 10 billion years. Or put differently, it's about equal to the number of seconds in 80 billion years. It's seconds like in, you know, there are 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 365 days in a year, times 80 billion years. Right? That's how many ways you can arrange those things. That's a lot of ways. Right? And so think about the problem. You can go test that. Think about the problem then that economies face, that we face as people living in an economy. We have enormous numbers of resources in the world. We have your labor, my labor. We have fish in the ocean. We have harbors. We have docks. We have a lot of capital equipment today. We have mineral deposits, lumber stands, land for growing wheat. Enormous amounts of just, you know, stuff that we can arrange in various different ways. Most of the ways we can arrange these things would be catastrophic. I mean, one way to arrange resources would be to have me standing over you in an operating room holding a scalpel getting ready to perform heart surgery on you, right? That's an arrangement of resources. You would die. I would be sued, right? And no one would be better for it, right? So what we got to do, it can't be just by chance. How can you take, I mean, if there are that many ways to arrange in one dimension, 20 resources, given that there are billions of resources in the world, trillions, how many different ways are there to arrange these trillions of resources? The mind boggles. It's just unbelievable. And yet, we have to find those relatively few ways that work. The relatively few ways that make sure that when we flip that light, the lights come on in this room. That when we press that button in the toilet, it flushes. That when we go into a clothing store, they have a blouse or a skirt or a suit in our size. That when we go to the doctor's not me, the doctor's someone trained in medicine, right? How do we do that? The world we live in is one full of human effort and creativity. I take it as a challenge. We have all these resources in the world, and one way to think of economic growth is the application of human ingenuity and human creativity and human effort in taking those resources and reconfiguring them, figuring out ways to get more output from them, not only to make wealthy people in industrial countries wealthier, but even more importantly, to make people in places like sub-Saharan Africa or in rural India wealthier, so that they can rise to at least the living standards that our ancestors of the 19th century were accustomed to. And the greater the number of people participating in that economic endeavor, the more creativity you have to figure out ways to use resources like that. One of the problems with restricting trade is that it artificially restricts the amount of creativity and effort we have in our economy. You can do it. You can do it. But by doing that, you make yourselves, you make your country poorer. I want to mention one other advantage of trade before going on to my final set of thoughts. Some recent research has shown, and I find it very compelling, and I admit I have biases to finding it compelling, but recent empirical research finds that free trade actually is associated with less belligerency. In other words, free trade promotes peace. There's a political scientist at Columbia University, Eric Gartsky. There's an economist at Rutgers University, Solomon Polachek, and a few others who have done a lot of extensive, very rigorous empirical research looking at the association between free trade, and peace. And they find that that association is quite high. Not only is there, no serious economist denies that there is a very strong relationship between free trade and living standards. Countries with less free trade have lower living standards than countries with high free trade. It's a very well-recognized, well-understood, and undisputed correlation. But we're now seeing also there's a correlation between trade and likelihood of peace. And I think that's a little bit more difficult to quantify than material living standards. I think that's a very important feature of trade. The economist Frederick Bastiat, who's a hero of mine, is often credited with the saying that if goods don't cross borders, soldiers will. I think it contains a nice insight. Unfortunately, I've looked for that comment in Bastiat, and I can find it nowhere. And I've read, I think, every word Bastiat has written. As far as I can tell, that statement was uttered, but it was uttered by a sort of low-ranking bureaucrat in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration in the 1930s, which I find somewhat ironic. But I forget his name offhand. Let me just end with discussing a few of the objections to trade. I pretty much spend my professional life now, when I'm not doing administration as department chairman or raising money for my department, I pretty much spend my life talking about and writing about trade. I do feel passionately about it. I should say, I feel so passionately about it. Audiences should know their speakers' biases. In Virginia, where I live, we're able to have vanity tags on our automobiles so we can, write little messages in our license plates, right? And, some people write, I love you and stuff like that, right? You get to have seven letters, right, and a space. You can't write much. But my license plate reads F-R-E space T-R-D-E, which I hope people understand means free trade, right? So my biases, I literally proclaim my biases on my Japanese-made automobile. Right. So I do read extensively in this area because I love it. It's a passion of mine. And I have to say, I have never encountered an argument against free trade in my lifetime that was not made at least, and that first made at least 150 years ago. Every argument given today, still given today, some by prominent presidential candidates campaigning in the Midwest in the United States. Every argument against free trade is older than the hills, as we say. They have been refuted time and time again with empirical work and in theory. And they come out again in different guises. Of course, the speakers are different. It's the same old wine being poured into ever newer bottles, and somehow people think that when you put it in a newer bottle, it will somehow taste better. But it's just older wine that, in my view, tastes worse and worse. There are countless arguments, of course, against free trade. I mean, there are many of them. The most typical, and I don't have time. I wish I did, because I literally could talk about this all night long. I love this stuff. The most common argument against free trade is that it reduces domestic employment. And you know the idea that, well, if our domestic citizens who were once buying, automobiles produced in this country suddenly start buying automobiles produced from a foreign country, well, it means less demand for domestically produced automobiles. The workers in those industries, some of them will lose their jobs. Unemployment will rise. End of story. But that's not the end of the story. Because you have to ask, why do foreigners sell things to us? There's going to be only one reason. Only one reason. Because they want to buy something from us. Or they want to invest here. I wish, frankly, foreigners would want to buy things from America and didn't want to sell things to Americans, didn't want to buy things from Americans. A lot of the discussion of trade, I'm sure it's the case here. I confess, I don't know for certain, but I bet my pension that it is. But a lot of discussions about trade presume that foreigners are somehow really crafty devils, and they want to send things to us: goods and services, electronics, automobiles, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, food, clothing, and they don't want anything in return. And what?
And toys.
Yeah, all kind of, yeah. And they don't want anything in return. I'm sorry?
Deadly toys.
Oh, well, that's another issue, actually. Right?
Well, it isn't.
on that point, I believe that free trade is to not treat foreign products differently than you treat domestic products. Right. Right. And so if there is an inspection regime for domestic products, then we can debate the merits of that. But if there is an inspection regime for domestic products, then it can legitimately be applied to foreign products.
Well, why wasn't it?
Well, it should have been. It should have been. There's some complications in here, but I won't dispute that it should be. To listen to a lot of Americans discuss trade, and I talk about this with my students, they really think that the benefit of trade is when foreigners buy things from us. And I said, no, the benefit of trade is when we buy things from foreigners. Right? The benefit of me going to work is because by getting paid, I get to buy things for myself. The benefit of me going to work is not the thrill and exultation I get from sitting at my desk talking to my students. I like it. I like my job. But, and maybe this will reveal me as being a selfish capitalist, I wouldn't do it if I didn't get paid. I mean, I just wouldn't. I do it because I get paid in a currency that allows me to buy things. Foreigners are no different. When Mr. Toyota sells something to me, and Mr. Toyota sells a lot to me, right? I like Mr. Toyota. I like his products. I never met him. Right? When Mr. Toyota sells something to me, Mr. Toyota doesn't, you know, I pay him in American dollars. And I assume that Mr. Toyota is no more fond of dead American statesmen than I am. Right? He accepts these things. This is an American doll, of course, a picture of George Washington on it. Now, I admire George. Right? But the only reason I'm holding this in my wallet, it's not like he's my son. I have a picture of my son in here. Right? I don't care. Look, here's a picture of the founding father of my country. Right? I can exchange this for something in the United States, something of value. Same thing with Mr. Toyota. When Mr. Toyota sells things to Americans, he accepts those dollars only because he knows he can spend them in America. So when you trace the path of those dollars, it's true. Employment in the U.S. auto industry might decline, but employment elsewhere increases. And the empirical facts bear this out overwhelmingly. There is no evidence at all that trade reduces the level of employment in a country. By the way, there's no evidence that trade increases the level of employment. The fact is, trade has no effect on the long-run level of employment in a country. What trade does do is shift employment from less productive sectors to more productive sectors. Because the industries that will most likely decline as trade frees up are those industries in any particular country that are less efficient in that country, then to protect those industries means you're protecting inefficient industries. And by protecting inefficient industries, you're preventing the development in that country of other industries. We might not even know what they are. But if you protect some inefficient industry here in the Bahamas, you can keep jobs there. You can keep profits in an industry up. But because now citizens of your country are not allowed to buy foreign goods that would compete with that industry, foreigners don't get those funds to buy from the Bahamas what they would otherwise buy and to let there be growth of... I'm sorry? I don't think that it's the case. I'm pretty sure it's the case that there's more than five things that you do, right? And just by the way, just because you do X, Y, and Z today doesn't mean that if you stop doing X, Y, and Z today that you won't do something different tomorrow. Look, one of the points I like to make about trade, it's true. Trade does shock a system. But trade doesn't shock a system any more than changes in consumer taste or technology shock a system. One example I like to use is in the summer of 1954. It was a major shock to the American, probably the worldwide, certainly the American economic, American economy. Because in 1954, the Salk-Sabin vaccine for polio was first used. And think of the terrible shock this imposed on the American economy. You had people who made money building wheelchairs out of jobs. People made money building crutches. Many of them lost their jobs. Nurses who tended to polio victims out of jobs. Now, it was a completely domestic change. Most of the changes in any country, even the smallest countries, most of the changes have nothing to do with trade. They have to do with internal changes, changes in the way consumers spend their monies, changes in technology. And those changes cause shocks. They cause displacements, just like changes in trade cause shocks and changes. And I see no reason for distinguishing shocks caused by trade from shocks caused by the many other ways in which economies change. One final note before letting you get to your dinner and my assaulting you is this question of trade imbalances. One of the things that's maybe perhaps the thing in the popular mind that's least understood is this thing called the trade deficit. I've come to the conclusion that it's a horrible development. It was a horrible development when governments started collecting data on trade, because it focuses the mind inappropriately. There is a trade deficit. Some countries have trade deficits. Some countries have surpluses. In the United States, the American economy has run a trade deficit every year since 1976. And it sounds bad. I mean, deficit, bad. Surplus, good. Right? And so I go around lecturing, and I ask my American audience, so how many of you know what the trade deficit means? And, I kind of stand up a little taller kind of to show that I'm there and I'm the economist, right? And, they must go, well, how many of you think it's bad? Well, they don't know what it is, but they think it's bad, right? And the trade deficit is nothing other than the portion of trade that comes back to your country as investment rather than as demand for goods and services. So if your country's running a trade deficit, there are some small exceptions if you're a really impoverished country getting a lot of aid from, like, the World Bank, but that's not the case in the Bahamas. It's certainly not the case in America. Right? So if your country's running a trade deficit, then all that means is foreigners want to invest there, and they are investing there. And I think, well, that's great, because more investment means more capital. More capital means more machinery, higher worker productivity, more R&D, more worker training, more modernized factories, more output, more retail space, all kinds of things that make the economy grow and prosper. So when I see the trade deficit rise, I applaud. But the fact that free trade, or when trade is freer, that it oftentimes causes so-called trade imbalances is taken as a matter of uninformed faith, I dare say, as evidence that trade doesn't work. But to understand what the trade deficit is, to understand the nature of trade accounts, and what the true name for it, by the way, is the current account deficit. Most people, I'm convinced that most television news reporters don't know what that is. They just read the news and say trade deficit bad, and they go, oh, and they sweat. And they, to understand what it is and to reflect upon it, I believe it would save a lot of anguish. I don't know how. I suspect some measurable number of suicides have been caused in the industrial world because people have experienced angst and anxiety over the trade deficit. And it's really unfortunate, since the trade deficit, in fact, in my view, is a happy development and not a bad development. Related to that is, and demagogues, politicians who demagogue on trade, particularly fond of making this point. They'll say, well, our country has a trade deficit with that other country. The United States has a trade deficit with China, and we do. And my response to that is always, well, so what? I point out that, you know, I don't work at a supermarket. I shop at a supermarket regularly, so I have an ongoing trade deficit with the supermarket, right? Go to the supermarket every, you know, two or three times a week. I buy a lot of stuff from the supermarket. Never buys anything from me. Never, right? My trade deficit in the supermarket is growing and growing and growing. It's getting bigger, right? By the time I die, it'll be astronomical, right? In other words, it doesn't mean that I am in debt to the supermarket. I pay. It's just that the supermarket doesn't buy anything from me. It buys things from someone else, but someone buys something from me. In our individual cases, we all have trade surpluses with one or two institutions, our employer mostly, and trade deficits with everybody else. There's no reason in the world to suppose that any one country would have balanced trade with any other country. It could happen, but it would be freakish if it did. It would be strange in the extreme if that happened. It'd be like a pink elephant falling through this room. It's possible. It's highly unlikely. Right? But yet, politicians get away with demagoguing this issue. Oh, we have a trade deficit with China. That means the Chinese are doing something wrong. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means you're dumb. Or you're lying and you don't understand the nature of trade and what these terms mean. I could go on a lot longer, but I'm sure I've taken too much of your time already. Again, I do recommend. It would be an import, by the way. It's an American-produced book, so I recommend that you increase the trade deficit of the Bahamas with the U.S. or whatever. And buy more from the U.S. and buy my book. It's too expensive. The publisher put a god-awfully high price on it. But if you do want to learn more about the ideas of globalization, you can read my book, but there are other good books to read too. The one I recommend most highly is a book by a Swedish economist named Johan Norberg. It's entitled In Defense of Global Capitalism. And he's got a lot of fine arguments and wonderfully well-presented data in that book to make a strong case for free and peaceful trade. So should I take some questions? Yes, sir. Well, I mean,
particularly in terms of the capital problems we're having today in the U.S. banking structure, and money center power saying that Citibank today is no.
Say the last thing again.
They said they weren't going to continue to financially underpin the capital of Citibank. This is the sovereign fund in Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
So the question relates.
Yeah, I think the distinction is there is a distinction, and it should be kept in mind, between the health of different firms and certainly different industries and the overall economy. One of the myths, you're not falling into it, but it reminds me, one of the great myths about trade discussions is to assume that a country is like a company. Japan Inc. And a country is not like a company. A company is a distinct unit that has a goal of making maximum profits for its owners or shareholders. A country is an organization of people, each of whom have their own goals and plans and jobs and aspirations. It's a very different thing. But when we talk about countries, it's very easy to slip into the idea that Japan is competing against Germany. It's not quite right, because you have a lot of different companies in Japan, a lot of different companies and people in Germany. I don't know enough about that particular case. I will say that,
I'm trying to use that as a point example.
But the banking...
The whole U.S.
Oh, I see.
I just was trying to get your view on that.
So the question is, am I sanguine or not about sovereign fund investments, right? Yeah.
Well, the impact on the balance of payments is whether it's...
Well, they certainly... I mean,
deficit is a constructive, you know, factor within the terms of your analysis of the trade
deficit. My prior is to regard all investment as... all market-driven investment as desirable. Now, are sovereign fund investments market-driven investments? That's a different question. And I think this issue is, I don't mind saying, I think this issue is still so new, and I haven't reflected on it enough to give an informed opinion. I don't think there's much question that as sovereign fund investments increase, they'll increase the balance of payment deficits in countries that receive them. It depends on whether you think that the sovereign funds themselves are in the long run good things or not, and I don't. My opinion on that matter is still not formed. What do you think?
Look at the value of the dollar.
Well, yeah, but the value. I think there are too many other factors that are potentially leading to the decline of the value of the dollar. The Fed has been inflating at a much higher rate than it was. Yeah, and so I think that's a big factor. The risk that a much more populist, interventionist Democratic president will take over the White House, scaring away some investors, and that reduces the value of the dollar. Regardless of what you think of those policies, I think that does dampen the dollar. And also, the European Central Bank has proven to be, I think, to a lot of people, surprised, much more prudent than people anticipated. I mean, you're a banker, right? So, well, the European Central Bank. I think the European Central Bank has surprised a lot of people with its restraint over the past few years. And so relative to the dollar, Bernanke's, the Federal Reserve Chairman now, is surprising a lot of people with his lack of restraint. The European Central Bank is surprising a lot of people with its relative restraint. Well, that's causing the euro to and other currencies that have somewhat more responsible central banks to rise relative to the dollar. I'm not sure that sovereign funds are playing a big role in there, but perhaps you're right. Perhaps they are playing a major role. Yeah.
I think one of the politicians' points when they discuss trade is that it disturbs a lot this market and this focus industry that disappear with it. And their recipe. It's already one of the most flexible economies in the world, but how can you improve that flexibility to reduce to the minimum those frictions created by the free trade?
Well, one of the policies that people often mention are to have government retraining programs. We have actually a lot of data on, at least in the United States, on government retraining, because they've been around for a while, at both the state level and at the national level. And the data, I'm pretty clear, they don't work. You look at workers who've gone through them, and they do more poorly than similarly situated workers who didn't go through those programs and just went out to get jobs without going through the training program.
I'm
not an expert statistician. You can talk about sampling bias and all kinds of things, but people who I do trust and who do referee these kinds of reports, they seem to be overwhelming in their conclusion that these training programs just don't work. Also, people will argue that we should phase in freer trade. In fact, that's what's done with NAFTA, for example. It's not that when January 1st. 1994 came along, it isn't the case that suddenly there was complete free trade between between Mexico, China, and the United States. That was just the day in which the effects started. In fact, I mean, NAFTA is a 3,000-plus page-long document, most of which explains how this phase-in is going to take place. My view of the phase-in is if it is politically necessary to get for your trade, I'm willing to do it, but I don't like it. I confess, when it comes to free trade, I am a push-the-button kind of guy. Right? If I could push the button today and have complete free trade, I would. I see no downside. I see no downside to it in the long run. It's true. Some people who today are in industries that are protected will suffer, but you'll have a lot of other people who benefit and gain. And as I was saying earlier, it's not just trade. In fact, it's not even principally trade that causes those kinds of sufferings. The kind of internal churn that goes on within domestic economies always causes more displacement than does trade. And so I don't see any reason why, I mean, if there is a moral case, even if there is a moral case for protecting people from the consequences of economic change, why single out people who are affected by trade, which is a fairly small source of economic change, rather than people who are protected from technological advances or just changes in consumer tastes, changes in organizational procedures. In my view, there's no reason for. But the reason we do isolate them is because it's politically expedient to do so. And if that's the price we have to pay, I'm willing to pay it. It was figurative, of course. Yeah. Huh? Figurative. Yeah.
But, I mean, the linkage, I think, to a lot of outsiders, it's extraordinary how the Americans allowed Toyota and Mr. Datsun and Mr. Nissan to come in. And the result now, 30 years later, is the collapse of Detroit. So what about the broader dimension of the moral side of there are large numbers of people becoming unemployed and so on? I mean, isn't that a poor consequence of free trade?
No, I don't think so. I think that to the extent that the Japanese were able to supply automobiles, better deals to Americans, made life better for Americans. Why should Americans be forced to buy from producers located in Detroit if they want to buy from producers located in Kyoto?
Because what they do, they come in with loss leaders for 2 years, and they undercut the market.
Subsidies present another issue. The vast majority of trade complaints don't involve subsidies. Some of them do. But my view of subsidies, and I'm sure this is not very popular, my view of subsidies is if a foreign government wants to subsidize my consumption, I feel sorry for the foreign taxpayers who are paying for that subsidy, but I'm not going to look that gift horse in the mouth. In the case of Detroit, Toyota came in, or Nissan, I'm not sure it's the case, but I take your word for it. Toyota, Nissan came in with loss. They had to. Their products weren't as established in the American market in the 1960s when they first started coming in as were American products. And so they had to be sold at a discount in order to get Americans to see that they were fine automobiles. And then they're now provide a fine product. I don't see the problem. BMWs in South Carolina.
Yeah. And so what you have is, it isn't, yes, one can argue that the total content of the car that is assembled in South Carolina may have a higher Japanese content than a car that is still assembled in outside of Detroit. But nevertheless, what you have is you have a migration of the industry outside of the, into those areas.
Yeah, the
compensation there for workers working there in those countries and those states is not far different than the real income that a still employed Detroit worker gets. It's just that he has a lower nominal income and he has a lower nominal cost of living, and he isn't that far off.
And they do, you might know this, they do, I think, have the productivity of workers in those plants, I think, is higher than in the Michigan plants, which is one, which is why they can pay higher wages. Oh, well, of course, during the recent presidential campaign, the Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were stumbling over each other to see who could criticize NAFTA the loudest. I wonder what Bill was thinking when this was going on, given that he claimed that as one of the centerpieces of his presidency. One of the many things that fascinated me about that discussion is the presumption, which went unquestioned, as far as I can tell, by the major media, is that Ohio was somehow devastated by NAFTA. So I went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's very easy to do. It took me, I timed it, because I wanted to say, it took me 21 seconds. Right? Went to I have the BLS thing bookmarked in my internet page. Huh? What's that? Bookmark. Favorites, yeah. So I go to the BLS, I go to the state section, I hit on Ohio, seasonally adjusted unemployment rate. I went the years, I think I went back to 19, just to get, make sure I got off, 1980 through the most recent, when I did it a few days ago, it was December 2007, and I saw that in December of 1993, which is the month before NAFTA went into effect, the unemployment rate in Ohio was 6.5%. In January of 2004, the month NAFTA went into effect, the unemployment rate in Ohio fell to 6.1%. It has never been as high as 6.5% in Ohio since. As recently as February 2001, it was as low as 3.9%. Today, more recent data have just recently come out in January, the January unemployment rate in Ohio is 5.5%. It's a full 1 percentage point lower in Ohio today than it was before NAFTA took effect. And then I went back and I averaged the previous 2 years before NAFTA went into effect, the unemployment rate in Ohio for the previous 2 years. It was 6.9%. And then I did the average of the unemployment rate in Ohio since, well, from January of 94 until December of 97. Oh, what was that number? 4.9, I think. 4.9%. So the average unemployment rate in Ohio since NAFTA has gone into effect is fully 2% lower than it was in the 2 years prior to NAFTA going into effect. Now, that doesn't prove that NAFTA had, you know, was a great blessing for Ohio. There are other, Texas is doing much better under NAFTA because Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas has much lower corporate corporate income taxation than Ohio. Ohio has some real problems. But the presumption that Ohio is somehow, basically indistinguishable from Rwanda, which was the impression you got from listening to the candidates talk, is not supportable. The economy's done reasonably well since NAFTA went into effect. The unemployment rate is lower. Real wages are higher by, I think, 11% over that time. Real total compensation is higher by close to 20%. For non-supervisory workers, that's not bad. But the press didn't know this. They didn't know enough to clip to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and to find what the unemployment rate was. And after Barack Obama kept saying, well, millions of jobs have been lost. Millions of jobs have been lost. And I should say, the total level, I forget the numbers, the total level of employment in Ohio is higher. It's not only the unemployment rate is lower, the total number of people employed in Ohio today is greater than it was in 1993. So the rate and the level are higher. Yeah. Rates lower and the levels higher. Yes, yes, sir. Well, there's a lot in that question because, I mean, culture is different than ownership status, for example. New Zealand had a fairly radical move toward freer markets and freer trade starting in 1986. I mean, they've gone back a little bit since. Of course, New Zealand is known for cheap farming. And I understand that the return to sheep farming in New Zealand has gone up dramatically. All the sheep farmers in New Zealand were frightened that if they moved to a freer, more open market, that they would be devastated. So my understanding is that New Zealand is really prospering in this way, and it's still full of sheep as before. I'm not sure it can be said that. You know, there are places where culture doesn't change. I mean, it is true that trade generally changes cultures. By the way, one of my favorite examples of this is ancient Athens. There are some histories of ancient Athens. Historians have pretty widespread agreement that in the 100 years prior to the Periclean century, the 5th century BC. 100 years prior to that, Athens was pretty much a local economy. Then it went to be sort of a pan-Grecian economy. And then by the time, beginning of the 5th century BC, Athens was a Mediterranean-wide economy. And I've read a lot of historians who have no ideological axe to grind. They're just reporting on what their researchers tell them about ancient Athens. I've read more than one historian who says, you know, it was this openness to trade that created Athenian culture. Created Athenian culture in a couple of different ways. Right? Number one, it unquestionably increased the wealth of Athens, of ancient Athens. And by increasing the wealth of ancient Athens, it increased the leisure opportunity of people. If you have a subsistence economy, even Plato or Aristotle, if they're starving, they're not going to come up with the politics or the Eudaimonian ethics, right? They'll starve. And so it created wealth, that created leisure, that created the ability of people like Socrates and Aeschylus and Thucydides to thrive. But also, and I like this point especially. The argument that at least one historian I read, Will Durant, makes is that when trade opens, as he puts it, I forget the exact quotation, but he says something like, suspicion butts up against suspicion, fiction butts up against fiction, and people are forced to think in ways that they weren't forced to think before. And these superstitions cancel one another, and reason begins, as he puts it. Reason begins. They may be going a little bit too far, but the exposure to different cultures causes you to think differently. And so it's naturally going to cause your own culture to be a little bit different than what it was. I think of the American culture. What is the American culture? People talk about it all the time, and I think of my own life. I don't think I'm that atypical an American. I mean, I'm a college professor, which makes me, I guess, untypical. But my dad went to sixth grade. He was a welder in a shipyard. I think of my life. I drive a Japanese car. My favorite musical group is the Beatles. I love Beethoven. I drink coffee from Guatemala or Colombia. I use CDs. That was developed by a Dutch company. Think about the things that just, and I'm sure it's pretty much the same for people in the Bahamas, that I use on a daily basis. They're from all over the world. And so, you know, the idea of I'll tell you a little story just a minute. The idea of, you know, a culture that's somehow identified with and unique to and situated on a particular piece of land, I think it's not. I think it's incorrect and not accurate. My sister, this is what I like to say. My sister, a few years ago, she was born and raised and still lives in New Orleans. She didn't go to college. And, I love her dearly. And when I flew home to New Orleans, I remember it was just before Hurricane Katrina hit. So it was the summer of 2005. And my sister picked me up at the airport. And she's 6 years younger than I am. And so I said, let's get some lunch. And she said, you know, I feel like some ethnic food. And I said, well, I like that Italian restaurant there. She says, no, ethnic food. And I think it's a kind of, you know, ethnic Italian food so common in America. It's not ethnic anymore. It's just food, right? She was thinking like Thai or Ethiopian, right? And, you know, I suspect that 50 years from now, someone's going to say, let's have some ethnic food. Oh, well, let's go to that Thai restaurant. It's not ethnic. It's just Thai, right? And so my colleague, it's a long answer to your very good question, but I have a colleague at George Mason, a man named Tyler Cowen, who is, I think, the world's leading expert on the economics of culture. He has two books. One is entitled In Praise of Commercial Culture. The title kind of gives it away. And his second book is entitled Creative Destruction. And these books explain very nicely, in a lot of rich detail, the relationship between open commerce and culture. And it really makes reading these books, I think, makes you optimistic about what happens with cultures when they're exposed to trade and open commerce. A couple of things. So let's say the United States and the Bahamas is not. I mean, they can take a really bad case, right? Like United States and Mauritius, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hey. Right. It isn't the first thing. It's not the United States trading with Haiti. It's people in this place we call the United States trading with people in this place we call Haiti. This isn't the whole of America trading with the whole of Haiti. And so, you know, the kind of David Goliath, I understand the appeal of it. The David Goliath analogy doesn't, I don't think, quite works. Right? Right? Yeah, I understand. What you're talking about, I see what you're talking about, and it's a real concern. I will submit, though, I don't think it has much to do with whether or not the trading partners from a rich or developed country or not. It's because the concern you express would hold even if the trading partner comes from a poor country. If they can bring it in, at a lower price, right, then you still get the same negative consequences. That, right, whether the exporting country is rich, poor, or middling, right? You still get the same negative consequence.
It's the size we're talking about. The size of it. If U.S. goods were allowed, for argument's sake, tariff-free, whatever, we're just talking about in a vacuum here. For example, this happened, I think, in the citrus industry. Florida, the amount of trade and citrus production at low cost in Florida, I don't know, I'm a new boy here, but I understand that the citrus industry in this country was destroyed by competition from Florida. So it's a question of dimension.
Economies of scale are a source of efficiency. And that My answer is no, although there have been several noted economists throughout history who believe as you do, most notably John Stuart Mill, although he changed his mind late in life on that. Let me ask this question. Suppose a new seed variety were invented that allowed the same amount of crop and same quality of crop to be grown, but on much less land using far fewer workers. Would you say that before that new seed variety is introduced, we should protect workers from that introduction of a new seed variety? It is the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Because in both cases, you have a lower cost substitute for what these workers are producing. And the only difference is that in one substitute happens to be produced in a different political jurisdiction by other people, and in the other case, the lower-cost substitute is produced by a technological advance. But they're economically identical. They're identical concept. They're identical things. Yeah, but that would happen with the improved seed variety too. You have the very same effect. I mean, you may answer yes. We should be protected from that technology. Some people throughout history have, but I would be content if I can just persuade you that it is exactly the same thing, and the consequences you have.
I only read, from time to time. It seems to me that the proponents of free trade quite naturally oppose free trade because they think it will benefit them, their country, and their inhabitants. Right? For example, in the Free Trade Association of the Americas, I remember reading that Canadian lumber was considerably cheaper than U.S. lumber. And I'm not sure who did it, but I definitely read that the U.S. lumber industry got a big tariff slapped on Canadian lumber.
Yes, they did.
I mean, what's free trade about that? That's protectionism.
Oh, I agree.
And I think it's good. One should protect one's own family and one's own country.
No, I disagree, because when Uncle Sam protects the U.S. lumber industry, Uncle Sam harms other American workers and industries. The problem is that harm is much more dispersed, and so it's not seen, it's not focused upon. I'm sorry?
Everybody who purchases a house is suffering.
You have higher costs as well. Is that? Okay. Well, thank you all.
Thank you, Dr. Boudreau. Obviously, as you can tell, it was very good. Everybody had lots of questions, and I bet they had lots more. But unfortunately, the time is tight, and we have to keep moving. Now I'd like to introduce Rick Lowe, Secretary and Treasurer of the NASA Institute. Yes.
Yeah, he's getting his dinner now. We apologize to everybody for that, but I have a very distinct pleasure. There's a lady who arrived late, unfortunately, but we still get to do this. The Nassau Institute has something. We presented in our tenure three of these little awards that we call the Nassau Institute Freedom Award. And there's a lady in the audience by the name of Leandra Sfakas who stood up. And she and another gentleman, Mr. Maurice Clinton, and they have taken our government to court on a constitutional matter. And the Bar Association, we think, has finally stepped up to the plate. If I say anything wrong, please correct me. She's also taken another matter to the court that she has won, another personal matter that we won't go into the details. But we sincerely appreciate what you have done. And here's a little memento. It will be suitably engraved, but we didn't get a chance to get it done.
Well, I really appreciate that. That's quite a surprise. And for those who are wondering about the perennial constitutional action, it still exists. The Bar Association made an application last year to substitute Mr. Glinton and I as plaintiffs, which was a very welcome application. And that order was given last year to substitute us finally. And the action will be proceeding, I hope, without too much delay. As I'm sure a number of you appreciate, the legal system, contrary to what's reported in the newspaper as being quoted by me, does not work quite as well or as fast as it should. But we persevere and hope that the end results will be beneficial, particularly as regards this constitutional action. Thank you very much.
And now I'd like to introduce Mrs. John Thompson, president of the Nassau Institute, for some words.
First of all, I really don't have anything much to say. I think it's been all said tonight. I can't speak about trade. I believe in trade. I've been a businesswoman all my life, and of course, trade is what makes us wealthy. We all know that. The Institute is trying to bring Dr. Boudreaux, people like Dr. Boudreaux, to the Bahamas to stimulate our thinking about these subjects. We know they're important. There's not a person in this room who isn't well aware of the importance of our understanding economic behavior, economic action, and what it means for the wealth and health of our country. The problem is sometimes we are so busy with our lives we don't really think beyond the political or the propaganda that's out there that is confusing. And it's from time to time, our job as the Institute is to focus on some of these ideas as we can afford to do by bringing people like Dr. Boudreaux here. We are so really grateful to you, Don, for coming because you bring something special to us. That's good trade. I don't know what you're getting back, but what you have brought us are your perception and soup. Okay, well that's okay. But thank you. It's my delight that you could come, and we hope you'll come back. Larry Reed comes back, so we'll put you on the list to come back and speak again. I hope you will. Oh. Oh, right. So I have a little gift here, a little presentation for you. So you'll have to come back. I'm not sure that it's signed. You may have to bring it back to get it signed.
But okay. Well, thank you.
Don, that's so you won't forget the Bahamas.
Thank you.
We love our country. I think I pretty well said it all. Rick thinks I should say some more. Is that enough? Well, we hope you continue to support the Institute. It's your Institute, too. It's not ours. It's something that has been in the germination stage for how long? 15 years, coming up for 15 years. It's really time now. It started to sprout. But we can't do it on our own. We need the support of people like you. The business community is stepping up to the mark here. See these wonderful supporters here that make this evening possible, this kind of thing possible. We just need to do more of it. That's what I can say. And we're a facilitator for that. Okay? Thanks.